You only need to say the four-letter word hula to conjure up sights and sounds in other people's heads. The sight of a swaying grass skirt and the sound of a slack-key guitar, for example. So we know what hula is on a basic level, most of us, but there's a lot more to it. Our guest this hour gives us a history of the Hawaiian art form and profiles some of its practitioners in a book called The Natives Are Restless. A San Francisco dance master takes hula into the 21st century. The book takes a particular focus on the San Francisco company Nale Hulu I Kawekiu, founded by Patrick Makuakane. Constance Hale, the author of the book, is giving us another side of herself today. She joined us a few years ago to talk about her book on language, sin, and syntax, but she's also been writing about Hawaiian culture for a long time now, with articles published in Smithsonian and The Atlantic, among others. Turns out Constance was born in Hawaii and started dancing the hula at age 7. So, Constance, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff, and I can say aloha ka kahiaka since it's still morning.
Okay, I'll stick with the aloha part. The rest will take a little more work. This book looks like really a homecoming of sorts for you.
It is. Thank you for saying that. I have been writing about Hawaiian culture my entire professional career, as you mentioned, but it's been hard to get the stories out, hard to get editors in New York interested in Hawaiian culture. Partly, I think, because it suffers from some stereotypes that are really inaccurate. So it was really a wonderful privilege to be able to take on a subject like hula and try to work in the history of Hawaii, which is an amazing, a fascinating story. And the evolution of hula itself is interesting. And then, of course, for me, it had such personal resonance because of growing up there and loving the hula my entire life.
Well, the elements you mentioned are all sort of woven together inextricably in the book, which is interesting. So you get the history and the dance and the story of this company as well. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the importance of hula in Hawaiian culture. It's a major part of the culture, it seems.
It is, and I think a lot of people, let's start by saying that hula, people think of hula and they think of, you know, if they have a stereotype in their mind, they think of lovely young women flapping their hands from left to right. Actually, hula, to really understand hula, you have to understand the poetry. So hula is an embellishment. The movements of hula are an embellishment to the poetry. Hawaiian culture, before Cook arrived, Captain Cook arrived, was a pre-literate culture. And chant and song were the literature of Hawaii. So the encyclopedia, the history book, the children's stories, the sacred text, the Bible, was all encoded in chant and hula, genealogical stories. So to really understand hula, you have to start there. It starts with the poetry and this amazing language and beautiful poetry, a long tradition. And then since the arrival of Captain Cook, many things have happened. The instruments have changed and the subjects have changed. But that's kind of the first thing you need to understand, is that underneath the hula or behind the hula or with the hula are these wonderful stories and beautiful poetry.
So let's talk about the particular focus in the book on a lot of it on Kumu Patrick Makuakane. Is the Kumu a title of respect for a teacher?
Kumu means in the Hawaiian language, Kumu means source or teacher. So yes, Kumu would be anyone who is a teacher of yours, you might call Kumu. However, Kumu Hula is actually a particular designation. It kind of indicates that someone has our equivalent of a PhD in hula. So a kumu hula has actually gone through a pretty rigorous training process and some somewhat esoteric rituals. And so kumu hula is really more, there's some esteem packed into that title.
Like a doctorate of hula or something.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So who is Patrick Makuakane? Where did he come from originally, and what has he done with hula?
Well, this is one reason why I chose him as my subject, or he made such a perfect subject for me. And the story that I wanted to tell is that he's also born in Hawaii. His father is pure Hawaiian. His mother is Caucasian. She's actually from Pennsylvania. So he grew up a biracial boy in Honolulu and started dancing. Actually, he didn't really like the hula as a young child. And it was when he was a freshman or a sophomore in high school that he joined the Hawaiian club and wanted to learn music, and was told that you don't learn, if you're there to learn music only, it's not the club for you. That's sort of a package deal. And so he started to learn hula, fell in love with it, and within a couple of years was dancing professionally in Honolulu, and so had a kind of professional career in his late teens and early adulthood. And then in 1984, he moved to San Francisco to pursue a degree at San Francisco State, and within a year had started a very small hula class, and that was 31 years ago. That original class of seven dancers has now 350 person arts organization, which includes 40 professional dancers.
And how do you pronounce the name of the company?
Nale Hulu Ika Vekiu. And it's a metaphor. Everything in many names and are in Hawaii, in Hawaiian, are poetic. And na lehulu, lehulu are very precious feather leis, often worn on the head. And it takes many, many feathers and many, many hours to make one. So na lehulu Ika Vekiu refers to the many feathered leis held in high esteem at the summit of the mountain.
Wow. And you yourself are a participant in this company. Can you still
I am. I started dancing with Kumu Patrick almost 20 years ago, and I've never been in his professional group, but love dancing and have had the unique privilege for the last 16 years, I think, of writing our annual newsletter, writing and editing our annual newsletter. So through that process, I've had the opportunity to write a lot about him and to observe him at close remove. And it was the combination of having written a lot about him and over time doing a lot of reporting and understanding his story, and then myself wanting to write a larger story about Hawaii. I had a thesis that I wanted to, or, you know, an idea that I wanted to express in this book. And I realized, you know, in the way that sometimes things right in front of you slap you in the face or upside the head, I realized I had the really ideal subject in him because, as I mentioned, his father was Native Hawaiian, mother Haole, as we call it, and he grew up in Hawaii, but he spent his entire professional career in San Francisco.
Really interesting story here. We'll get further into it as we talk more with Constance Hale about her book, The Natives Are Restless, A San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century. That dance master is Patrick Makuakane with Nalehulu Ika Vekiu. I think I got it right that time.
Yes, you did.
Excellent. Back to talk more with Constance, and we'll listen to some music as well and get a sense of some of the dances and hear from you if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Constance Hale, a fairly prolific writer. We talked to her a couple of years ago about her book Sin and Syntax. She's back to talk about a book on a very different subject area. It's about hula, the Hawaiian art form, and some of its practitioners. And it also gets a history of hula and a history of Hawaiian islands in there as well. The book is called The Natives Are Restless, A San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century. You got some comments of your own about learning or participating in hula? We'd love to hear about it. Or questions for Constance? 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Interesting starting point of the book. Your first line is, I am not the kind of person who talks to dead people. What does that mean, Constance?
Well, it's my way of saying hula is not what you think it is. And I'm a sophisticated urbanite writer, lived in San Francisco for 35 years. You wouldn't think of me as your typical hula dancer. Believe me, if you saw me, you would not think this is a nubile, young, lovely woman with flower in her hair. So I guess the point that I was trying to make originally is, A, hula is not what you think it is, and B, hula dancers are not who you think they are, and C, to really immerse yourself in the hula and to inhabit the tradition of the hula, one has to do many more things than dance competently. One has to learn the Hawaiian language. One has to learn chanting. And a lot of those chants are addressed to dead people. I mean, I'm saying that somewhat facetiously in the first line, but, you know, you do have to chant to King Kalakaua in the 19th century. Or there's one chant where we address the gods in the low-hanging blood-red rainbow. And so there are a lot of aspects of hula that, to do hula well, you have to wrap your mind around a lot of ideas that are not necessarily familiar, and that's part of the whole process.
And as you mentioned already, the stories are passed down through hula as well. There's a lot more than just swaying the hips and having a ukulele nearby. I mean, as you even referenced a Bing Crosby movie. So actually, let's get a sense of this too. So we have a chunk here from the Kumulipo Suite, or Kumulipo?
Yes.
Suite? Okay. So let's hear some of this and then talk about what we've just heard. So this is the Kumalipo Suite. This is really an origin story for Hawaii, isn't it?
It is. It's been compared by various scholars to Beowulf, or really Genesis. It's the Hawaiian Genesis, if you will. So it's an ancient chant, 11,000 lines long. As you can hear, it's a chant, and the instrumentation that accompanies the chant is a gourd drum. So one thing that people don't understand about hula, you think of guitars and ukulele, but actually in ancient chants like this, or hula kahiko we call it, the instruments are gourd drums, sharkskin drums, bamboo rattles, so mostly percussion instrumentation. That's not what people think of with hula. And then this is, Kumu Patrick was, I think, one of the first, if not one of the first, or to choreograph a hula to the Kumulipo. So the Kumulipo is kind of, can you imagine someone doing a modern dance to Genesis? It's just not what we pair together. But it's some of his brilliance, and what makes him interesting as a choreographer is he takes some of these ancient chants and he imagines hula that will go with them. And as you listen to that music, you have to imagine dancers on stage. And behind those dancers on stage are projected very large images of the things that the chant is describing. So the chant begins at the bottom of the ocean in the slime, and we kind of start there. That's the multimedia backdrop. And then there are images of fishes and manta rays. And as the chant describes the birthing of many species, including the human race, there's this combination of music, dance, and imagery.
I should point out that there are the book is lavishly illustrated with color pictures that portray things like the onstage presentation of the Kumulipo Suite. You can also find some YouTube videos, which I had a chance to crib that from Nali Hulu Ika Vekiu, to see and hear the sorts of things we saw. It's a very impressive setup, absolutely. So you describe Patrick Makuakane, the teacher, the creator of the company. You describe his mission using the word kuleana, which you say is hard to translate. But what approximately do you mean?
Well, in the old days, kuleana was, your kuleana would be perhaps the piece of land that you were given by the community to cultivate, and then you would bring the harvest back to the community, or the piece of coastline that you would fish in. So the idea of kuleana was, you know, the thing you did, the job, the piece of land over which you had stewardship. And so that over time, the idea of kuleana has evolved to mean kind of, it's the closest translation might be responsibility, but it might also be translated as privilege. It's the thing you are privileged to do, or the privilege you are given.
Sort of like the keeper of the hula flame for Patrick?
I beg your pardon?
Sort of
keeping
like the
hula flame? Yeah, I think partly it's sort of interesting because when I first asked him at the beginning of the book process, I asked him what his kuleana was, and I define that in the introduction of the book, and it's really to, you know, keep the tradition alive, grow the tradition, and in some ways for him to interpret what it means to be a Hawaiian in the 21st century and then express that through his particular art form. Interestingly, after a year of interviews and writing the book and conversations with him, he now defines his kuleana differently. He says he believes that his ultimate, most important responsibility is to foster a community in San Francisco, a community not just of Native Hawaiians or Hawaiian Islanders, people who were born in Hawaii, but many people who did not have a strong connection to Hawaii when they started hula, but have become committed to Hawaii and Hawaiian cultural values. And so he would tell you today that his kuleana is to build, support, foster that community where people live Hawaiian values, treat each other a certain way. And so that is that idea of kuleana is, you know, what are you uniquely positioned to do? And you must do it.
Do people not from the islands get the depth of Hawaiian culture, and is it still as ever present? I mean, is it still very rich in the islands?
Well, it is very rich, although I think you could go to Hawaii and not experience it at all. You know, as a tourist, as a visitor, you could go to Hawaii, you could stay in a big hotel, you could flop on the beach, you could drink Mai Tais, which is not a Hawaiian drink, you could, you know, wear plastic lays or a purple orchid lay, you could feel that you're in a different place, and yet you haven't experienced Hawaiian culture. So you really have to go on the prowl for it to a certain extent. You have to find the music and go to it. You have to find hula. You have to find real luaus. I mean, there are very many luaus that are produced for tourists that are somewhat remotely related to Hawaiian culture. Yet, if you set that task for yourself, Hawaiian culture is there. And if you know where to get it, so if you're someone like me who grew up in the islands and loves Hawaiian culture, it is thriving. There are festivals of hula. There is a resurgence of the Hawaiian language. There are amazing musicians who, you know, have played at Carnegie Hall. You just have to look for them because they're not playing guitar in the big hotels. So it has been, it really is thriving, and yet you almost have to go looking for it if you don't know. You know, one example of how it's thriving, one of my favorite examples is that in 1984 they did a study and they found that only 3,000 people spoke the Hawaiian language as a mother tongue, you know, sort of from birth or naturally, fluently. And among those 3,000 people, only about 30 or 36 were under the age of 60. So the language was on the brink of extinction. And scholars and educators and even ultimately politicians came together, and they started, first they started preschools, bilingual immersion preschools. The Department of Education got behind it. Now there are elementary schools all over the island, high schools. You can go all the way up to PhD, the PhD level in Hawaiian language. It's the most popular, quote-unquote, foreign language course at the University of Hawaii, and a language that, you know, 40 years ago was, or 30 years ago was almost extinct, has come back. So you can go to a school in Hawaii where everyone is speaking the Hawaiian language and they are learning Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian music. But as a tourist, you might not see that at all. Obviously, who of us go to elementary schools when we visit a foreign country?
Truly. Constance Hale is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's written a book that takes in Hawaiian culture, Hawaiian history, hula dancing, a company in San Francisco, all the above. It's called The Natives Are Restless. A San Francisco dance master takes hula into the 21st century. That's Patrick Makuakane at Nale Hulo Ika Vekiu. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your own hula stories or questions about what we're talking about here. 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. Was there as much pressure on Hawaiians, Native Hawaiians, to assimilate and drop language and culture as there was on Native Americans on the mainland?
Oh, absolutely. Arguably more. So in 1893... the Hawaiian government, which was a constitutional monarchy, an independent kingdom, was overthrown by a group of merchants and American and European businessmen. And then in 1895, they established a quote-unquote provisional government because the United States realized that the overthrow was not really legal. They were pressuring to have Hawaii made a territory. Eventually in 1898, in the Spanish-American War, the United States annexed Hawaii, and they did it without a treaty of annexation. Some consider that to have been an illegal action. After which, things like the Hawaiian language in schools and government offices was banned. You know, there was a lot of attempt to assimilate the Hawaiian people into the United States. And places like Kamehameha Schools, which is a private school specifically endowed by a princess in the 19th century to educate Hawaiian children, Kamehameha Schools was really considered its job to train nurses and policemen and firemen, not to save a culture. All of that, thankfully, has changed. The Kamehameha Schools is now an amazing resource for Native Hawaiians, and the education has really changed. But there was really a century in which a large project was to assimilate Hawaii into the United States. And then when jet travel and tourism started, you started to get a huge influx of Americans in Hawaii, and now influx of Asians as well. I mean, Hawaii is right in the middle of the Pacific, and there are very many people living in Hawaii who do not have that long history in Hawaii. But there was definitely an attempt to suppress Hawaiian culture, and many Hawaiians embraced the idea of being American. So I don't want to make it seem like it was not a two-way street.
Was hula itself ever really at a low ebb?
Yes, it was. I mean, it really was in the, I would say, in the 20th century, hula. In the 19th century, King Kalākaua had hula dancers at court, and it was really, hula was really revived under King Kalākaua. And then, yes, it became something that was practiced at home, that was kept fairly secret. Some of the most respected hula dancers who had were repositories of ancient knowledge did it secretively. It was quite, you know, there was... Religion had the Christian religion had come to Hawaii, and hula was, by many people, hula was looked on with a little bit of, you know, looked at askance. And so, yes, there was a diminution of the hula, and then really in the 50s and the 60s that started to change, and in the 70s it really started to blossom and take off.
Let's take a call here. We have Evelyn in Gold Beach. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Constance Hale.
Good morning.
Oh,
you know, I never knew that I could be so fascinated by hula. What an incredible program today. And I just love the author's energy. You know, they say do what you love and you'll be successful. But anyway, long story. Sorry, intro into my question. So there are male hula dancers and female hula dancers dancing together, and I'm just wondering if, I mean, is there an energy that each brings that's necessary, you know, to get the feeling and the point across? And anyway, just wondering.
All right, excellent question.
Just, you know, coincidental.
Oh, thank you. That is such a great question. And again, it goes to the stereotype that we associate hula with young, nubile women, and yet, yes, men are very much a part of the hula tradition. And so just to give you an idea, in class, sometimes the men and the women dance the same song, and you dance it identically. The choreography is the same. And this more or less the same values would be encouraged in the dance. So, you know, the motions are the same. However, in many dances, the men will have a slightly different, there's something we call a pas, which is the chorus kind of in between verses. And the women might do a much more graceful pas, and the men might do a more athletic pas that's in between verses. And then there are songs where the man's choreography is very different from the woman's choreography. In fact, last night in hula class, it's confusing because you're doing your motions, and if you're dancing right next to a guy and he's doing something else, that can be quite confusing. Then there are dances that are solely for men and solely for women. There's a dance that I learned, shouldn't have learned it probably in the fourth grade, but things weren't so strict then. It was called The Boy from Laupahoehoe, and it's a dance about a boy who, you know, goes out and he paddles his canoe and he does this and he climbs the coconut trees and he comes home and he eats his poi and he gets strong all over his body. And that's The Boy from Laupahoehoe, a very common dance, a boy's dance. And then taking it to a more professional level or a more intense level, there are warrior dances by men with sticks, and they are fierce and they are masculine and they are athletic. And so that's one thing I love about hula, is this intense variety of dances, and many dances for men that are quite athletic and quite warrior-like. And yet there are dances for men that are beautiful and lyrical as well. So, and women, too, there are dances that are lovely and lyrical. But then there are chants that are quite, we do one chant that's a protest chant. And it's, you have to find your inner warrior when you're chanting that chant. So thank you for the question. It's an astute one. And just one other answer, there is kind of a male in the Hawaiian worldview, there's a male principle and a female principle. And so I think you will see those different ideas of maleness and femaleness embodied in certain hulas.
You were just talking about a protest dance, which brings up the ways in which Patrick Makuakane at the company in San Francisco has brought modern politics and modern thought onto the stage as well. And so I want to invite our listeners to use your imaginations as you listen to the words in the birth certificate hula.
We're a long way from Africa. Honolulu doesn't look like Kenya, so you have to do
So I think we know what we're talking about there, the questioning of President Obama's birth certificate. Is this the kind of stuff that Patrick brings onto stage regularly?
Yes, it is. It's one of the things that makes him really different from any other kumuhula is he does the ancient dances as they've been passed down over the centuries. He does more modern dances, which are from the 19th century and the 20th century, lovely music. And then he has invented a new style of dance, which he calls hula mua. Mua means to go forward or to go into the future. And so in hula mua, he pairs non-traditional music with traditional Hawaiian motions. The birth certificate hula is kind of, it's not quite a hula mua because it's still pretty traditional music. It's guitars and ukulele and four-part harmony, but it is English words, and it's not a traditional Hawaiian song. Some of his more arresting and groundbreaking work takes non-Hawaiian music like jazz or like Roberta Flack or Michael Jackson's Dangerous and even electronic music and choreographs hula motions to non-Hawaiian music, and that's what he's really known for.
We have an example of that when we come back from this break. We'll take one now. The book is called The Natives Are Restless, A San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century. Constance Hale wrote the book and is a member of the company as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Constance Hale, a prolific writer who has joined us in the past. Her earlier book that got her on the exchange was Sin and Syntax. Totally different realm of stuff we're talking about today. We're talking about hula, the Hawaiian art form. Both the history of it, some history of the Hawaiian Islands, and a particular profile of a San Francisco company. In her book, The Natives Are Restless, A San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century. That would be Patrick Makuakane and his company, Nale Hulo Ikavekyu. And it's a really interesting look. A lot of pictures of the dances as well. As I pointed out earlier, you can check out some of these dances on YouTube as well, because Nale Hulo does maintain its own channel on YouTube. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about hula in past, present, and future. 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And we were just talking about using modern non-hula kind of music with some additional overlays. And so here's an example of that. And anybody alive in the 80s will instantly recognize the tune, if not the words. So that is, in fact, the music from Spandau Ballet's True from the 80s, but with a Hawaiian overlay. So this is the kind of stuff you were talking about, Constance, before the break. Patrick taking modern music forms and setting hula on them.
Exactly. And in some cases, the lyrics of the original song may complement or express something very similar to Hawaiian poetry, and so he might pair them for that reason. And sometimes he, in that case, uses it as a backdrop, and then he overlays Hawaiian chanting. It's a really interesting project, and I have to say, I don't know that anyone else could do it quite like he does it. He had a brief few years where he was a DJ, and he does his own mixes, and he does his own blending of different things, so it's, the music itself is quite unusual. It's often more or less created by him through the process of mixing. And then he has this way of imagining a particular story, a particular Hawaiian story, or a particular hula that may work with that. Now, another example that people might be able to imagine is Roberta Flack's First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. You would never think of that as a soundtrack of a hula, but it's one of his most popular dances. And the women are dressed in long velvet gowns. Their hair is pulled back in a chignon. They have big white lilies in their hair. Absolute elegance. And the dance is very slow and beautiful and breathtaking. And so he's working with the music. He's working with the artistry in the original music, and then he's kind of adding on this other layer. And as an audience member seeing it, it's interesting because for those of us who come from Hawaii, we hear certain music and we have a whole host of associations with that music, and we bring a lot of associations into our consciousness as we watch the dance. Kuma Patrick is very aware that for a lot of his audiences, they don't have those associations. They don't know the meaning of that particular song. They don't remember Gabby Bahinui playing that when they were 12 years old. And so I think for him, part of this, I mean, I think he just loves all kinds of music, and he loves working with all kinds of music. He's kind of a musical omnivore. But I think also he's very aware that he's working on mainland United States, and his audiences may not understand the Hawaiian context or may not understand the Hawaiian words. And by using music that they are more familiar with, he kind of cracks, it's almost like your heart gets cracked open in a certain way by this dance.
You quote Patrick as saying he's not trying to turn hula on its head. So So what does he see this as?
Well, he just sees it as moving hula forward. I think he would argue that hula has always, that Native Hawaiians have always been fluid in their culture. And so when Westerners arrived in the 1850s, Spanish cowboys came to Hawaii to work on ranches, and they brought the guitar, and Hawaiians took to it like crazy. They did not have a history of playing string instruments. They loved the guitar. They took it and they innovated with the guitar. They created first slacky guitar, our own style of guitar.
And you did your master's thesis on that, didn't you?
I did. I actually did. And then they created the steel guitar, which became, you know, popular in country western music. So Hawaiians have always, the Hawaiian culture has always responded to other influences and taken other influences in. So I think he sees what he's doing as a continuation of a long process in Hawaiian culture of somehow retaining Hawaiianness, maintaining tradition, maintaining certain values, and yet also growing. So I think he would argue that it's great to save a culture, and it's important to save a culture, and we want to save the culture, and much of his endeavor is to preserve a very special culture, but he doesn't want it to get fossilized. And so he's kind of walking. And again, we talked at the beginning about why did I choose, or why is Kumu Patrick Makua Kane a particularly good subject to tell this story. It's not coincidental that he's half-half, you know. He's half-half, he's biracial. He spent the first half of his life in Hawaii, the second half of his life in San Francisco. I think he's a person who has a foot in two worlds, and that negotiation between those two worlds really defines the essence of what he's doing creatively.
Is there much of a debate, Constance, about pure traditional hula versus putting contemporary elements and contemporary music in it?
Yeah, there is quite a debate. So, for example, if you go to the Merry Monarch, which is kind of the Super Bowl of hula competitions in Hawaii, it's been going since 1964. It's impossible to get tickets. It's a huge hula festival and competition. And you will not get points at the Merry Monarch for dancing to Roberta Flack. So there are definitely people who are traditionalists who want to, you know, preserve Hawaiian dancing in a certain way. And Kumu Patrick is, however, that said, there is a very strong effort to preserve tradition. And actually, within our classes, Kumu Patrick's very traditional. So within the classes, he's very traditional. He does his innovations on the stage in his professional company. I should make that distinction between what he does in the classroom and then what he does with his professional dancers. But he is one of, actually, and part of the reason I had wanted to write about this new cohort of Hawaiian artists that he is part of. So it's kind of like a new generation of Hawaiian artists in their 30s, 40s, 50s. They grew up, the generation before them grew up at this time where the Hawaiian culture was on the brink and needed saving. This generation grew up when that process had begun, and they grew up maybe speaking Hawaiian, the Hawaiian language, or they grew up, you know, thinking that hula was saved, you know. And there are a number of other, so there's an, for example, a musician named Kaylee Reichel, who's quite a groundbreaker in music. There's a duo called Kupa'oa, who are not satisfied just playing the old standards over and over again, but who are composing new songs in the Hawaiian language and really growing the Hawaiian repertoire. So there's a cohort of people, and I think the title, part of the reason the natives are restless is such a perfect title for this book is, number one, it describes him and his work, and there's one of his signature theatrical performances is called The Natives Are Restless. But I think there's a restlessness among Native Hawaiian creative artists that is expressed through Kumuhula, Patrick Makuakane, but he's not the only practitioner. And that was part of what I wanted to write about as well.
You know, I noticed that some of the work that Patrick Makuakane sets upon his company in San Francisco is also somewhat directly pointed at the suppression, the oppression of Native culture. In fact, doesn't he use the words of one of the oppressors in one of his pieces, the Reverend Hiram Bingham?
Yes, absolutely. And that's The Natives Are Restless. So we need to, I'll talk about that piece just very quickly. That piece was originally choreographed in 1996. There was a very long piece that he got a grant for called Selva Mea, and that's the centerpiece of the original Natives Are Restless. And that piece portrays the violent conflict between Native Hawaiian culture and missionary culture. It portrays it maybe more violently than it was actually in history, but there you have this sense of a dangerous and, you know, violent confrontation between cultures. The missionaries wanted to Christianize the Hawaiians. They were scandalized by hula. They were scandalized by topless women. They were scandalized by the exuberant sexuality of Polynesians. And so there was a real conflict there, and that is captured in this piece. I should say, though, the piece has a second level of meaning, which was it was performed after it was choreographed during the AIDS crisis, and there was a feeling of anger on the part of Kumuhula, Patrick Makuakane, at Christianity, at the forces in society that were judgmental about the gay community and resisted helping during the AIDS crisis. So there's kind of a double meaning to that particular piece. Anyway, that piece was the centerpiece of the original one-act performance, The Natives Are Restless. The piece as a whole, Natives Are Restless, told the story of the tragic collision of cultures in the 19th century, and Hawaiians did not come out on top of that particular conflict. The first act ends, and you feel very sad. It's really a tragic story. But he felt that in the last 20 years, and I think this is, again, what I was saying, is there's a resurgence, there's this new coterie of Native Hawaiians who kind of like, you know, we're not victims. We actually didn't lose our culture. We want to celebrate our culture. We want to grow our culture. And they are also, there's, in the past 20, 30 years, there's been a very fierce culture of resistance in Hawaii to over land use, over water use. There's a lot of resistance right now to the idea that a huge telescope is going to be built on top of the biggest mountain, Mauna Kea, mm-hmm. in Hawaii. They have Native Hawaiians have organized. They managed to block the groundbreaking of that. It's back in court, very similar to the North Dakota Access Pipeline struggle. So Kumu, in the second, after 20 years, he decided to add a second act to The Natives Are Restless.
Wow.
And the second act really portrays the 20th century and now the 21st century. It's very political. It's very activist. It is not what you expect from hula. There are a lot of fierce, angry hulas in that particular act. But there are also some beautiful hulas conveying. For example, there's one beautiful hula that celebrates and honors the fact that Native Hawaiian community and the Hawaiian community generally just restored an ancient fish pond, very large fish pond, and there was a huge project to restore this fish pond and start using it again as the ancients had. So it's not just a story of anger and rebellion, but it's also a story of Native Hawaiians, you know, sort of picking up the pieces and moving forward. So The Natives Are Restless, the whole show basically takes us from, it opens with the words of Hiram Bingham, who was the leader of the missionary delegation in 1820. And what he wrote in his journals about Hawaiian culture is sort of blood-curdling. You know, it's really, there's just tremendous judgmentalism and almost a hatred for the Native culture that he discovered in Hawaii. And the piece opens with a voiceover of the actual words of Hiram Bingham. So it's very powerful stuff.
Absolutely. Sounds compelling. And, of course, it is the title of the book as well. We have a final question here from John in Vinita, who says he went to a luau and saw the dancers throwing fire sticks and wants to know what that's about. And I guess I would add to that, is that authentic or is that a tourist add-on?
That's a tourist add-on. The fire dances are more from Samoa and other islands. So typically if you go to a luau in Hawaii, you might see a little bit of Hawaiian dance, but usually they also have Samoan dancing, sometimes some Tongan dancing, some Maori dancing. So it's kind of a cross-Polynesia, and the Hawaiian culture gets a little bit lost in the mix.
No doubt. It's a really interesting book. The Natives Are Restless, A San Francisco Dance Master Takes Hula into the 21st Century. The dance master is Kumu Patrick Makuakane. The company is Nale Hulu, Ikaveku. And we have learned about all this from Constance Hale. Constance, thanks for joining us. And I want
to
point out
we're
going to go out with Nale Hulu doing San Francisco, the old Scott McKenzie song, done hula style with the dancers. A good way to end the show today. Thanks again, Constance, for joining us.
Mahalo, Jeff.
Mahalo. And thank you for listening to the Jefferson Exchange today. Our producer's Emily Curitan. Emily Pfeiffer's at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Take care and have a great day. Such a strange vibration, people in motion. There's a whole generation with a new explanation. People in motion. Some gentle people.